Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Our guest on A Bard's Eye View today is really more than a guest now. He's become a friend. Jalil Marbrook, who has a wonderful new book out. Actually, it's been out how long?
A little over a year now.
Yeah. Brushstrokes and Glances, a book of poems, and it's published by Deerbrook Editions. And for me, it was a revelation, in a way. You, Jalil, have literally poured so much of yourself into this volume. What was it that you set out to achieve in the reader via the often tenuous or metaphorical connection between these two art forms? And I will begin by telling you that while I'm a great appreciator of art, and we have many pieces in our home, etc., I can't tell you from a technical point of view why I like them. As a youngster, the best I could do were stick figures. So that will give you sort of a background. But I have a deep love of great art when I see it. But you have made such an effort, really. And I see it as an effort of many years to make a connection between these two art forms.
It is a project, maybe perhaps even a lifelong project. I had an early exposure to the French surrealist poets, because when the poets and the artists fled Europe because of the Nazi advance, many of them came to New York. And my mother, an artist, was hanging out with André Breton and many of the French surrealists. And of course, by that time, I was a young teenager, and I had already read Baudelaire and Rimbaud. So I kind of related to the roots of the surrealist poets movement. And because the surrealists were so influential in the art world and so influential on certain artists, I just grew up thinking that there was an intricate relationship between painting and poetry. I don't know that I included sculpture in my thinking at that point. And this book was a revelation for me. It was kind of a spiritual journey, because I was trying to understand my own feelings about paintings, and I realized I rather much regard my life as witness to the beauty that I see, witness to the paintings. And I think probably that's why I also indulge in a lot of photography. But the final revelation for me in doing this, putting together this book, was that I saw as a poet, for some reason, I don't know how it came to me, that I'm here to pay homage to this beauty, but I'm not here to be recognized for having paid homage to this beauty. I'm here to see, but I'm not here to be seen. And that to me was startling and life-changing. Because, you know, writers spend a great deal of their lives, trying to get their work published, and then when it's published, trying to get it reviewed and promoting it and marketing it. And this book and also my own photography just convinced me that I'm here as a witness. I'm here to testify to this beauty that I see. And that's what most of these poems are about. Sometimes I talk to the paintings, sometimes they talk to me.
Well, it's interesting that you've gone off on that tack, because I came across an interesting quote by T.S. Eliot on art, in which he says, "The only way of expressing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative, a set of objects, a situation, a chain of events, to be a formula of that particular emotion."
You know, I'm quite familiar with that quote by Eliot, and I think art lovers are quite familiar with it. And immediately when I read it, and I don't know at what point in my life I did read it, I thought of Cézanne and the relationship between the bare canvas in Cézanne and silence in poetry and in music. I mean, without silence, there is no poetry
or music. The spaces between.
Exactly. The interstices, so to speak. And that's what struck Braque and Picasso when they saw their first Cézanne in a window, was not only the bare canvas, of course, but the interstices between these cubist configurations. Sometimes I think of them as the cracks between the worlds or the cracks between dimensions.
I wonder if there might be a poem in this book that sort of reflects what it is you're talking about now.
Here's a poem where I do talk about bare canvas.
Uh-huh.
And of course, when we think of bare canvas, we usually think of Cézanne. It's called "Wishing Someone Gone." When I read it at readings, I see a lot of eyebrows raise. Shall I read it, Paul?
Please.
"I'm not sure how well a life can be lived celebrating the absence of another, but it can make for a hell of a party. The case for silence is very strong, so absence can be argued as bare canvas, but if not pentimento, there's at least the memory of paint. Knowing how little one will be missed is probably easier than finding out you needed to keep on wishing someone gone. Absence and presence is all one thing, the danse macabre of canvas and paint, of silence and its carnival interruptions." It's really Cézanne who got me to thinking as a poet about the importance of silence and about how primitive words are and even language. You know, Proust, I think, was the one who said that all language is a nostalgia. It's a kind of homesickness, you know. I sort of think, I mean, this is a metaphysical idea, but I sort of think that we came here speaking a common language, a lingua franca of atoms, and that what we think of as language rather much gets in the way. And so the job of the poet is always to be cautious about the flotsam and jetsam, the debris, to get rid of it.
Also, I think it's important for us to remember that the poet is also a messenger of the changes that are taking place around him or her and how that affects the language. Or
yes.
Sometimes how the language affects the changes. And as a former musician, I am very much concerned about the rhythm of a poem. And sometimes that gets in the way of the language, too.
It does. take Swinburne. You can get drunk on Swinburne before you even know what he's talking about.
Exactly.
That's right.
There are so many poems in Brushstrokes and Glances, and I did have one final question that I wanted to ask. I found something by a poet that I think both of us think a great deal of, and that's Richard Wilbur.
Oh, yes.
And I just happened to come across this. "Wilbur has always been conscious that his particular poetic gifts accurate vision, copious eloquence, spiritual resonance, and his great subject, the richness and adequacy of the natural world, were untimely. Indeed, he started writing, as he later recalled, quote, for earnest therapeutic reasons during World War II, in an effort to bring the sanity of art to bear on a personal and an objective world in disorder.
That's what I think of museums. They restore my sanity.
And I wondered if there might not be a short poem that might reflect something like that.
Perhaps. I'll read you two stanzas from a poem. This is a poem from a sequence in this book called Manhattan Reef, in which you and I have talked about this, about a vision of Manhattan underwater.
Which took place.
Which then actually happened.
Before Sandy.
Yes, it took place before the hurricane.
Yes.
I can Bruegel one Sunday afternoon, El Greco for a moment, Van Gogh till I beg for darkness, but museums suggest we're from different stars and have only a short time to visit. That's just a stanza.
But it's a powerful stanza.
I don't know why I had that vision of man, but I know when it happened. I was walking along 34th Street, and I looked up to the Needle Empire State Building, and I envisioned a dirigible anchored to it. And then I said to myself, well, of course, that's what's going to happen when Manhattan's underwater. Ships will moor themselves to the tops of skyscrapers, you know.
I could go on forever, but we can't. And the name of this marvelous book is Brushstrokes and Glances by Jalul Marbrook, and the publisher is Deerbrook Editions. Do yourself a favor and get a copy.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me. I love talking to you.
As always, a pleasure.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.